So how do you bring the Messiah? This seems to me a fairly urgent question. And there are people who have theories about it, who will tell you that you can bring the Messiah by doing this or by doing that. And generally, the theories fall into two broad categories. One theory says that you can bring the Messiah by doing old things. That is, following ancient texts, ancient mitzvot, by carefully adhering to what that book says. Other people will tell you the opposite. The way you bring the Messiah is by modern technology and new inventions and new discoveries. That in fact, the Messiah is brought by progress and not regress. And I've come here this morning to split the difference, which is, I think, a good conservative approach. And I can prove it in part by addressing first the old mitzvah question. Is it in fact Judaism's teaching that in order to bring whatever the messianic age is, you have to do everything in that book? It's clear, to me at least, that the answer is no. In our parsha this week, we read an infamous law, the law of the Ben Sorer Umareh, the rebellious son. What do you do with a rebellious son? According to the Torah, you take him out to the public square and you stone him. In the immortal words of Bill Cosby, I brought you into the world and I can take you out of it. Right? That's the approach. If a child is rebellious, that's what you do. Now the rabbis, and remember we're talking 2,000 years ago, looked at this law. And they decided the Torah couldn't have meant you stone a child. It couldn't be. So first they hedged it around with various qualifications. Has to be within a few months of his bar mitzvah. Has to have been warned right before it happened. He has to have, it says he was a drunkard and a glutton, so they start to define how much he had to eat and drink before he committed it. But even though they have effectively qualified this law out of existence, they're still not comfortable. So they end up their discussion by saying, the Ben Sorer Umareh, the rebellious son, lo haya velo nivra, never was and never will be. Now if this was a unique instance, you would say, okay, so there was one law in the Torah that the rabbis could not countenance. But just before this, we read about the Ir Nidachat, about a city that is proscribed where everyone in the city is to be slain. Do you know what the Talmud says about an Ir Nidachat? Lo haya velo nivra. One never was and never will be. Now if you say that the rabbis had commented that one never was, because after all they know Jewish history, then I accept it as a statement of reality. But once they say one never will be, it's a statement of values. It's about the fact that 2,000 years ago, the people who shaped our tradition knew what Whitman, the great American poet, said almost 2,000 years later, which is, to have a great book, you must have great readers. And that in order to read any sacred text properly, you have to bring to it a feeling heart, a modern sensibility, as well as an ancient one. And that no book speaks for itself. No poem, no play, no painting, no book will yield its secrets unless you, as the observer, the listener, the reader, extract from it what it has to give. And the reason the Torah is a great book is not solely what it says, but the way in which the Jewish people have over generations read our book. I'll give you another example from this week's Parsha to reinforce this idea. Ki Tetzeh, when you go out to war, is the beginning of the Parsha. Did you read what it goes on to say? And you find a woman and you take her captive. Now, this happened in war. Obviously, the male population was the most likely to be killed, and women were taken captive. It happens today, and it happened in the ancient world. The Torah tries to humanize this process. It says you have to keep her for 30 days. She has to weep for her home and her parents, possibly her husband whom she left or was killed. All of that. You have to shave her head to try to make her unattractive to you to encourage you to send her home, which is a way of trying to make her unattractive without injuring her. And then, if at the end of this process you decide to marry her, but you may not enslave her, you may not sell her, because after all, you're responsible for her fate. Rashi, the traditional commentator, comes along and doesn't like this. Giving people ways of keeping captive women from war. So he says, very reasonably, this is a concession to the Yetzer Hara, to the evil inclination in people. Realizing that people will do this, you're saying, look, if you're going to do it, you at least have to do it humanely. Rambam, Maimonides, comes along shortly after Rashi, and he doesn't even like that. He says, actually, what happens is you have 30 days to convince her to convert and marry you. And if you cannot convince her to convert and convince her to want to marry you, you have to send her home. To have a great book, you need people who will read with their hearts. You can make a savage sacred text out of any sacred text in the world. You can do it from the Bible. You can do it from the New Testament. You can do it from the Bhagavad Gita. You can do it from the Quran. Pick your sacred text. They all can be made cruel. Because no text speaks for itself. What we are proud of is not only the Torah, but the way in which we have read the Torah. What it has taught us. What we have learned from it. How it has helped us grow. Books shape us. But we shape books as well. The German aphorist Lichtenstein once said, a book is like a mirror. If a donkey peers in, you can't expect an apostle to look out. Except he didn't use the word donkey. But it's Shabbos. I bring this up because, in fact, the idea that religion is unchanging is an idea that betrays the Torah. It's not faithful to it. If we read this book the same way that it was read 1,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, then we haven't grown. Then we haven't learned. There is a beautiful Hasidic story about two disciples of a rabbi. And one of them, exactly and slavishly, word for word, letter for letter, followed everything that his teacher had told him. And the other developed his own interpretations, his own nuance, and his own direction. And one day the two of them met, and the first one said to the second, I'm so disappointed in you. We studied together at the feet of this great man. I don't understand how you could have betrayed him, how you could have violated his legacy, how you could have taken all his teachings and ignored them. And the second said, actually, I could say the same about you. Because I think I'm the true disciple. You see, my teacher grew up and left his teacher. And I grew up and left mine. It's part of a process that parents learn with children, that teachers learn with students, and that every generation has to learn with the generation that follows. That is fidelity and creativity. Reading with ancient eyes and with modern ones. Knowing that the world does not stand still because we get dizzy. And that we have to move as the tradition moves. And so the question of how you bring the Messiah is a question that involves ancient teachings and modern ones. You have to both have a fidelity to values that don't change and understand that some innovation and some creativity and some difference are essential, and so is story. Here is how to bring the Messiah. The story goes that once there was a beautiful and famous yeshiva in Eastern Europe. There was only one problem in the yeshiva. All the students and teachers constantly bickered and fought with one another. In other words, it was a typical community. I once read, in fact, a book called Cloister Walk by Kathleen Norris, who was a writer, became a nun, and she lived for a while in a monastery. And she said, the problem with the monastery, the way the prioress, the woman who ran the monastery, put it, is not that they had doctrinal differences. It wasn't that they disagreed about the teachings of the church. The problem was that everybody's mother had prepared potatoes differently. You know, that's what you, little things, that's what you argue about. And that was what was going on in the yeshiva. And it was tearing this yeshiva apart. And day after day and week after week, this monument to learning was crumbling. But the head of the yeshiva heard that a famous rabbi was coming through town. And he thought he would seek him out and ask his advice. And the rabbi came through town, and the head of the yeshiva came, and he sought him out, and he said, Rabbi, we're so glad you came to town, because we need you so badly. The yeshiva, everybody is fighting and bickering. Everybody is at each other's throats, students and teachers. It destroys our learning. It hurts our community. What should we do? And the rabbi said, you know, actually, I'm in town to deliver a message just to you. That's why I have come. And the Rosh Yeshiva said, what's the message? And the rabbi said, I want you to bring this message back and tell it to everybody in the yeshiva. Don't miss anyone. He said, yes, I will. So the message I have brought you is one of you is the Messiah. So the Rosh Yeshiva went back and he told the people in the yeshiva, one of you, the rabbi told me, is the Messiah. But I don't know who. And so they understood that they had to treat everybody in the yeshiva as if that person might be the Messiah. And day after day, week after week, slowly, gradually, but surely, people stopped bickering. They stopped fighting. Petty things regained their pettiness, and they were no longer issues of contention. Things that didn't matter anymore really didn't matter anymore. And only that which mattered, only that which human beings should in fact thrash out and understand, became issues not of contention, but of discussion and of exploration and of learning. That is an ancient teaching, and one that Judaism insists on. At every Brit Milah, there is a Kisei Eliyahu Hanavi. There's a chair for Elijah, because that might be the time that Elijah is going to show up and say, this one is the Messiah. Because anyone might be. All we have to do is put that ancient teaching in a modern context and start treating each other as though any of us might be the Messiah. Because if we do that, not only in our families, in our communities, but in the world, then indeed, the Messiah will have come. Shabbat Shalom.